Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's a good friend and a fellow car enthusiast. His name is Eric Peters. Eric, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Thank you for having me, George. It gets me out of the Antarctic ice bunker that I'm stuck in for now for a couple of days anyway.
Yeah. So for my viewers who aren't familiar with what you do, can you give them the kind of Reader's Digest version of kind of your business and how you evaluate cars from a libertarian standpoint?
Yeah, I guess I never really thought of it as a business, even though I guess I do make my living doing what I do, which is to write about cars. And it runs the gamut from new car evaluations in the old car and driver style, not the new car and driver style, with an eye toward how fun they are, not whether they're green enough and safe enough, and also all the things that are just sucking the joy out of not just driving, but out of life generally, ranging from the cult of sickness eternal, all the way through the various shady political dealings that just continue to roll over us like an endless tsunami.
I listened to your most recent interview with our good friend Tom Woods, and you really opened up my eyes. This week, for people listening or watching, today is January 19th. So Davos 2022 started a couple days ago with the World Economic Forum, the global elite meeting there. And you really started to get into the weeds with Tom on how they are manipulating the car industry to try to kind of influence consumer behavior in a certain direction, possibly the direction they want to go for, let's just say 2030 agenda or whatever it is. Can you get into the weeds on that? Because I just found that conversation fascinating.
Well, sure. And I start by using a different word than influence, which is kind of a benign thing. I'm all for presenting people with pros and cons and alternatives and letting them make a decision based on whatever happens to suit their situation best. Well, what's more accurate, a more accurate word to use to describe what's going on is that they're trying to force everybody into a particular mode of transportation. And that's the word that they like to use in lieu of driving. And so essentially what that means is they want to get you out of your personally owned car. And they've been talking about this behind closed doors for many, many years, but now they're talking about it openly. Because I guess it's become so obvious, there's no point in even trying to deny it anymore. And one mechanism for doing that is this electric car thing, which has been aggressively pushed to the front of the stage now, allegedly in the name of curtailing carbon emissions. But if you dig into that, you find out that that's actually, even if you accept the whole climate change thing, the electric car is not the solution to climate change. They're energy hogs, and they use a lot of electricity. Where does most of the electricity, at least in the United States, come from? Well, it comes from burning coal, oil, and natural gas, which creates a whole lot of carbon emissions. And proportionately speaking, electric cars use much more energy in an equivalent pound-for-pound basis than a gas-powered car does. A typical electric car has about 1,000 pounds of batteries. Someone posted something on my site about this today that I thought that was really informative or got me thinking about it. Think about how far you could go on the equivalent of 1,000 pounds of gasoline. How far that 1,000-pound battery pack is going to take you. A typical electric car has about a 250-mile best-case range. So that's what you get for 1,000 pounds of batteries, as opposed to, let's see, about 3 or 4 gallons of gas in an economy car will take you that same distance. And they know this. And this is where it starts to get into the dark territory. They know that there is not only an emissions justification for this or an efficiency justification for this, but they have to know that there simply isn't the generating capacity out there to provide the necessary electricity for a hypothetical fleet of however many cars there are in the United States right now that are all electric. 100 million electric cars, where's the generating capacity going to come for that? They know that it does not exist and that there is no money to conjure it into existence. So what's going to end up happening is that electricity is going to be rationed. And the way they're going to ration that is limit, if you have an electric car, assuming you can afford one, limit the amount of electricity that you're going to be able to put into the thing, whether by outright cutting off the juice or by making it so extortionately expensive, you can't afford to do it. And the end result is you will be chained to wherever you are, unlike what we've all come to accept as sort of a given, that we can just jump into our car whenever we feel like it, without really thinking about it very much, and going wherever we want to, and being able to afford to do that. And, you know, any high school or college kid just about can afford to jump into a beater car and just go somewhere. Good luck doing that in the electrified future.
Right. So basically what they're trying to do is price people out of the market.
Yep.
So they, and but let's dive into that a little bit more. You talked about how they're pricing people out of the market with their need for energy for their vehicle, whether it's gas or electricity. But let's talk about how they're pricing people out of the market from buying a car in the first place.
Yeah, well, one of the problems, the obvious problem in getting people into an electric car is that you still have this choice. There's a disparity. You can go out right now and you can buy a brand new non-electric basic car for $20,000 or less, as compared with the-
Yeah, you and Tom, I think we're talking about one at like 15 grand. Like
there are a number of cars that fall into that category. A Nissan Versa starts out around 15, a Hyundai Accent around the same. There are a number of cars. You get a Corolla, a little bit nicer, a little bit bigger, for about $17,000, $18,000. The least expensive electric car is the Nissan Leaf, which is about $30,000. You know, so that's a problem. So what do you do? Well, what you do is you make the non-electric alternative, at least and preferably from their point of view, more expensive than the electric car, so that there really is no longer any financial disincentive to not get the electric car. You know, you just kind of make it all a level playing field, if you can even use that phrase in the context of this artificially manipulated market.
So they're trying to, so how are they trying to increase the price of that Versa?
Well, they're doing it in a number of ways. One, I guess the best example most recently is the federal government through Biden announced a substantial increase in the mandatory miles per gallon minimums that the federal government has been decreeing since the 70s. And they've always been increased incrementally, just a couple of miles here and a couple of miles per gallon there. Well, Biden wants to, he decreed that they are going to go up from about 36 miles per gallon now to about 50 miles per gallon by the 2026 model year, which is, you know, 4 years from now. And the thing of it is, there isn't a single non-hybrid or non-electric car that gets 50 miles per gallon. Now, it doesn't mean that the manufacturers won't be able to continue building cars that don't average 50 miles per gallon. But if they do, they get socked with what are called gas guzzler fines. Okay, and those fines end up being folded into the price tag of the car that doesn't meet the 50 mile per gallon standard. So it gets more expensive. And the more expensive it is, the fewer people can afford to buy it. The fewer people that buy it, well, that creates less incentive for the car manufacturer to keep building it, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get this kind of reduction spiral where there's less and less and less each passing year. And you can see this manifesting in, remember when luxury cars, if you paid $50,000 for a car, let's say, you got a bare minimum, you got a six-cylinder engine under the hood of that thing. And oftentimes you got a V8 engine for about $50,000. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Well, that's all out the window now. $50,000, a Mercedes E-Class, a BMW 5 Series, you get a little 2-liter four-cylinder engine with a turbo on it. And if you want a V8 engine, you pretty much have to spend six figures. So you can see this winnowing that's happening. Most recently, some cars that are beloved by me, and I'm sure beloved by you and people listening as well, the family of latter-day muscle cars that's made by Dodge, the Charger and the Challenger, and also vehicles like the Ram truck and the Jeep Grand Cherokee that I've been test driving this week, they're going to stop making the Hemi V8 engine that powers those vehicles. And it's not because there's no demand for those vehicles. The current Charger and Challenger are ancient vehicles. They haven't changed them significantly in 11 years, but they sell like heated gloves to Eskimos.
Right.
You love those cars. And why wouldn't you love them? They're big, traditional American cars with big V8 engines, lots of room, six people can fit in it, huge trunk, and that wonderful V8 engine. Well, they want to take that away from you. And they've succeeded. Chrysler knows Chrysler, the parent company, Stellantis of the whole combine, they simply cannot continue to manufacture those vehicles and sell them at a price that people can bear when they have to make them somehow achieve 50 miles per gallon. It's just not going to work.
So it's not that the companies have to have an average of 50 miles per gallon throughout their entire fleet of
vehicles. Yes, exactly.
It's each car has to.
It's the average. It's the totality. But if you think about how it was back in high school, you know, you had six classes, let's say, and if you got a D or an F in one class, what did that do to your average? Even if you got B's and A's and everything else.
Yeah, it brings it down substantially.
Substantially. So that's the problem. You know, these fines are exorbitant. And if that doesn't do the trick, the other thing, which is sort of the ace in the hole from the point of view of these people, is to establish these, and I'll put it in air fingers quotes, emissions standards for carbon dioxide. And it's a really sly and oily trick. When people hear emissions, most people assume what you're talking about are the things like unburned hydrocarbons that contribute to smog, particulates, soot, things like that. Things that everybody understands are bad. They're bad for public health. Nobody wants these things. But carbon dioxide has absolutely nothing to do with smog. It's got nothing to do with acid rain. It's got nothing to do with making statues turn dark because of all of that stuff. You know, you can say, oh, well, it's about climate change, but they're dishonest about it. They don't put it in that context. They style these cars that produce a certain amount of carbon dioxide as dirty to convey this emotional, this idea in people's minds of something that's foul and has to be has to be taken off the roads because it's a threat to public health. It's extremely dishonest, and it's also very effective. The only way to get rid of carbon dioxide, you know, you can't chemically use a catalytic converter to reduce it. You can't. The only thing you can do is make an engine smaller and smaller and smaller until it's essentially non-existent. And that's why you're seeing tinier and tinier engines. There are a number of SUVs running around, big SUVs, you know, 5,000 pound vehicles that have 2-liter engines in them. It's the craziest thing. You know, they managed to maintain the power by putting on a turbo. And lately they're adding mild hybrid systems to it, which usually means they've got like a 48 volt electrical system and a quick start flywheel generator starter to cycle that gas engine off and on as often as possible. But at the end of the day, if you posit zero or nearly zero carbon dioxide emissions, the only way to do that is with an electric car.
Okay, so I want to, let's just kind of walk through the average viewer, listener, who might not know a lot about cars, and they could be listening to this and saying, well, Eric, that doesn't sound that bad to me, because when you're talking about them with an SUV that's got a 2-liter engine, it's burning a lot less fuel through using a battery pack and this hybrid system. Well, I mean, that's kind of a win-win, right? Because they're having to buy less gas, and therefore, and plus they're polluting the air less. To what degree, you know, that's up for debate, but it's less, so that's better. So why is that not a good thing? Because what I'm trying to do here is I want to walk them through a cost-benefit analysis. Sure, those might be the benefits, but what are the costs?
That's the argument that the government puts forward. They'll say, we're going to pass this edict that raises the mandatory fuel economy average to 50 miles per hour. You're going to save so much money on gas. They don't tell you is how much you're going to spend to save all that money.
Right.
Right. Nothing's free in this world. And in order to get a drivetrain that gets 50 miles per gallon, you're talking about a hybrid drivetrain, generally speaking. They've outlawed diesels, you know. So the only way you can do it with a gas engine is with a hybrid drivetrain. So now you've doubled the complexity of the drivetrain. Literally, you now have two drivetrains. You have a gas engine and you've got a battery pack, big battery pack. You've got electric motors, usually there are two. And all the peripherals that go along with that, they're not installing that for free. You know, that substantially raises the price of the car. And if you want to look at about how much that is, compare what the cost of a typical hybrid car, like say a Prius is, with something that's otherwise comparable, that's about the same size, you know, that's roughly about the same power. And you'll see that the price differential for the hybrid is about $4,000 to $5,000. It's a big chunk of money. How much gas would you be able to buy with that? And pencil it out and think about, okay, so I'm going to own this car for 10 years. And over the course of the 10 years, this car is going to save me. I'm going to get, let's call it 8 or 9 miles per gallon more than I would have otherwise because of this government mandated hybrid system? Am I going to be able to drive back the $4,000 or $5,000 additional that I had to spend? Probably not. I mean, who knows? Maybe the cost of gas is going to go up to $6 or $7. And if it does, maybe then. But at the end of the day, you're still paying more. And you're paying more in multiple other ways, too. These cars.
I was going to say, talk about the maintenance, too, I'd imagine. Yeah. Because the more stuff and the more kind of tech that you add to a car, the more you're going to have to pay to fix it.
Of course.
And the more things that can go wrong.
Right. The more complex anything is, the more likely that at some point, some part of that system is going to need to be looked at, going to need to be replaced or repaired. That's just inevitable. That's the way things work. So it's why, as a rule, if you want a durable vehicle, you want a simple vehicle. A traditional V8 is an understressed engine. It doesn't have to work very hard to make the power. And yeah, it burns more gas, but it's not going to burn a hole in your pocket probably over the long haul, because it will probably outlast the vehicle that it's in. The vehicle will start to rust before that engine has a major issue, probably. Whereas with these turbocharged micro engines and these hybrid drivetrains, something's going to go wrong. And keep in mind that cars depreciate. Each year that you own that car, it's worth a little bit less. And once you get to this kind of an event horizon around 6 or 7 years or so, depending on the car, you reach that tipping point where fixing the car relative to what the car's worth is now a bad financial decision. You know, you're not going to put a $4,000 transmission, let's say, into a car that's got a retail value of $7,500. It's just stupid, right? But I mean, you're stuck. What are you going to do? If you put the $4,500 into that $7,500 car, the car's not worth $4,500 more. It's worth the same as it was before, but now you can drive it anyway. So I guess that's something.
And so what do most people do in that situation? Do they, you know, do they just, I would imagine if you sell the car, you take a massive hit.
Yeah.
You can barely sell it for anything. Do they trade it in for then let the dealer?
There you go. It's part of this agenda is to chain people to serial debt, to serial payments.
Right.
And with cars, the way that happens is, you know, okay, your car has some major problem. And what are you going to do? You need a car, but you really can't afford to get it fixed. Well, you take it to the dealer, and the dealer folds the cost, you know, whatever you're losing on that old car, into your new payment. Mm. And, you know, you drive off with the new. And that's what these people want. They said so openly. What's the phrase about you'll own nothing and be happy?
Right.
You know, ownership is so 20th century. They want you on the Hulu or the Amazon or the Netflix plan, where you're paying every month. You never actually possess or own the thing. You just get to use it for a little while until the next payment cycle starts.
Right. So in the mind of the consumer, okay, I don't have the $4,000 to fix my car, so I can afford a $300 a month payment.
Yep.
So if I can go into the dealer, and if they can give me a new car, but yet I still have that $300 a month payment, well, then who cares? I'm good to go. And you're just not worrying about the fact that you're going to have to make that $300 payment for another 5 years.
Yeah, it's,
or an additional 5 years.
It's very seductive because it gives the appearance of material well-being,
right?
And
right.
Oh, look, I've got this new car, and I got to leave my money pit at the dealer. Yay for me! But you're chained to this financialized system where you're dependent on it, and you are beholden to it. And this dovetails into what's been going on with the vaccines. People are so desperate to keep their employment that they're willing to submit to being vaccinated, and I put that in air fingers quotes. With some, you know, nefarious, unproven, potentially actually dangerous substance, simply because they have to keep that job in order to keep up with their payments. Mm.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. So it really puts them in a position to where they have no choice but to submit to the will of the central planners in a way.
It's very difficult, isn't it? You know, if the more you own, the more independent you are.
Right.
If you own your home outright, if you own your vehicles, if you don't have any debt, you probably still have to work, but your work situation is a whole lot more flexible than it is if you've got a big monthly mortgage, you've got a big car payment, you have nothing in the bank, and you know that if you don't get paid next week, you're in real trouble. And you know that makes you, it puts you in the position of being served. You know, you're at their mercy. You have to do what they tell you, don't you? And you know, maybe you get to drive around in that nice new car, but it's a nice shiny cage in my opinion. You know, I'm far happier driving my beater old pickup truck. That's mine. I don't owe anybody anything for that thing, except of course what the government mulcts me for in terms of the taxes. But otherwise, it's my truck, you know, and that's just a really good feeling. And it's such a shame that Americans have lost sight of that.
That's such a great point. I mean, just a real world example of what we're dealing with in the world today. If you're someone who, you know, is really hesitant about, let's call it the medicine to keep it YouTube friendly. And I always tell people that I'm really not anti-medicine, but I'm definitely anti-medicine mandate. I mean, right. I'm as anti-medicine mandate as they come. But anyway, for that person who might say, I just got done with the Cerveza sickness. I don't feel as though I really need to take any additional risk. I don't have much upside, but I cannot tell my employer to pound sand. I can't even afford to look for a new job that wouldn't have these more draconian restrictions, because I've got a $500 a month car payment and I've got a $2,000 a month mortgage. Where if that person didn't have that mortgage, if they didn't have that car payment, they could easily tell that employer just to get lost. I quit and I've got plenty of time, you know, another 3 or 4 months just to find another job. And there's 10 million open jobs out in the economy right now. I'm sure I'll do fine.
Right, exactly. And it makes it almost impossible to accumulate capital when whatever capital you have is already spoken for before you even deposit the check.
Yeah, that's such a, I'm just thinking through that now as we speak, because on my videos, in the comments, and on my live streams, so many people ask me, what can I do to have more personal freedom? You know, I can't leave the country. And even if you could leave the country, the pretty much the best places in the world right now are Texas, Florida, and a couple of other states like that. And I just tell them, you know, you can do a couple of these things, but there's not much you can do other than, you know, be surrounded by a bunch of great people in an awesome community. Maybe have some gold, have some Bitcoin. But that's another great idea, a great piece of advice. Just don't have a car payment. Have as few monthly payments as possible. And assuming that someone else isn't making that payment, I'm thinking of a rental property. You know, if you got like a cash flow rental property that's positive cash flow, that you have 30-year fixed rate debt, that's completely separate. But as far as the payments that are coming out of your own back pocket, have as little as possible.
Yeah, and particularly with regard to cars, you know, real estate, that is a legitimate investment. A business is an investment. A car is an appliance. I love cars. And I don't mind spending some money on my toys. I've got an old muscle car. I've got some bikes and things like that. But I don't delude myself into thinking that they're investments. You know, certainly nothing new is an investment. It's you know, you're buying an appliance, and it's smart to look at cars just like you would a microwave oven or a dishwasher. And, you know, realize that it's something that you buy because it serves a purpose. And if it gets you from A to B reliably and safely and comfortably, that's good enough. You know, the rest of it is ego. I get it. You know, it's nice to drive around in a higher end vehicle that's got a 14 speaker Meridian sound system and massaging seats and all the rest of it. But when I was young, I read this great book. It was called The F-150 Millionaire. You ever heard of it?
Mm-mm, no. Tell me about it.
Well, I can't remember the guy's name, but the gist of it was this guy had become wealthy. And one of the ways that he had become wealthy was to drive his old beat up F-150 pickup truck.
That's cool.
To not spend money on appliances so that he had money to build his business. You know, he had cash. Rather than giving the cash to a finance company, he was able to go out and get real estate and put his money into things that actually made money. Cars don't make money. They're a tool to help you make money, but the car itself is a money loser by and large.
I want to come back to this in just a moment. I had a quick thought though. Are these auto loans that people are getting, are they a fixed rate or are they adjustable rate?
Well, I guess it depends. Generally speaking, they're fixed on new cars. The interest rates on used cars are higher. I'm sure it works a lot like in the real estate business. They're probably adjustable ones. I would never get into something like that, however, particularly with the economy the way it is.
Yeah, I'm just wondering because, you know, the Fed's talking about raising interest rates 3 times or maybe even 4 times in 2022. So obviously, you know, we know how that would affect the real estate market if you don't have a fixed rate loan. Just trying to think through if that is a potential problem for the auto loan market as well.
Well, the real problem with the car loan is the duration of the loan. You know, with a house, let's say, you know, you get a 15 or let's say a 30-year mortgage. You know, by and large, it's a safe investment because you know that at the end of 30 years, you're going to have something that's valuable. And ideally, it's not going to have lost money. And more than likely, it's going to have made you money. But with a car, as soon as you drive it off the lot, it begins to lose value. And that's an axiom. You know, unless it's an extremely rare exotic car, any car that you buy new, the moment you drive off the lot, it's losing value. Right. And that's why you've got this dilemma with the financing. They've already pushed loans out to 6 and 7 years. And that is the limit, because once you get to that point, you know, the depreciation has gotten to the point where, you know, you're underwater. You owe more on the thing still at 6 years than the car's worth. They can't, that's why they can't stick out these loans longer than that. You know, bankers are many things, but they're generally not idiots, and they're not going to write you a 10-year loan because they know that most people are going to figure out that around 7 years, hey, why am I continuing to pay on this thing? I'm just going to walk away from it.
Yeah, right. Just giving the keys. Okay. So this makes a lot of sense. Eric, with the depreciation, we all know how that works, but correct me if I'm wrong, but the majority or the largest percentage of depreciation occurs, what, in the first 2 or 3 years? So if someone was planning on buying a car with cash, I buy all my cars with cash myself. I usually try to wait and buy like a model that's 3 or 4 years old. Is that the sweet spot, or what would you suggest?
Absolutely. Because particularly with later model cars, they are phenomenally well built. So you pick up a 2 or 3 year old car, assuming you got one that somebody didn't pour sand in the crankcase and something like that. It's essentially a brand new car with 30,000-40,000 miles on it. It will look like a new car. It will drive like a new car. There's really no downside unless you're hung up on being the second guy to sit in it, you know, to not take the plastic off the seats. But you're going to save yourself an enormous sum of money. Usually at that point, you're going to be paying about 30% less than the new car sticker price. And that's huge. And the depreciation curve from then out will kind of be flatter. It'll
right.
still depreciate, but it won't be as precipitous. And I'm the kind of guy, my feeling is that you should drive a car literally until the wheels fall off, until it gets to the point where it's so expensive to keep it up that it's just not worth it. Well, I'm a cheapskate, but I feel like I'm a smart cheapskate about that stuff. They've suppressed this amazingly well, how reliable modern cars are, how common it is for vehicles to go 250,000 miles now without anything major happening to them. People are still stuck in this 60s and 70s mindset of a car with 100,000 miles on it being near the end of its life and being right. terrified of it. And, oh my God, it's time to get a new car. You know, there's nothing wrong with the thing. It runs great. You know, it hasn't given you any reason to think there's anything wrong with it. But, oh my God, the odometer just rolled over. I got to get a new car.
Yeah, and that's the programming or the conditioning that keeps you in that mode of serfdom.
Sure, and fear sells, doesn't it? You know, it sells at the dealership, and it sells at the medicine closet too.
Yeah, good point.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
you know, when you were talking about them trying to price people out of the car market to kind of motivate them, let's say, to use other forms of transportation that give them a lot less personal freedom, like a bicycle, as an example. Bicycle, you're pretty much chained to an urban area. If you want to live, you're not going to have too much success with a bicycle out in a rural area. But with a car, you can go pretty much wherever you want. I was thinking that through looking at the current housing market, where if you follow this at all, it's just gone up and up and up and up and up. And especially with starter homes, really builders cannot make starter homes any more a profit. And when I talk about a starter home, I'm just talking about your typical, you know, remember when we were growing up back in the 70s and the 80s, they would build these little kind of cookie cutter, three bed, two bath ranch homes.
Yeah, like 1,200 homes, square feet kind of
a deal. About 1,200 square feet. You got it. And that's kind of what the entry level home was. Well, nowadays you cannot build that home at a profit. It's not possible. So that's why the only homes that you see being built in big urban areas are usually at least 2,500 square feet. And they're usually luxury homes. Mm-hmm. So if you have more population, if you have more demand for these starter homes, the price goes up and up and up to a point where people cannot afford to buy a home, period. And they have no other choice but to live in just an apartment. And, you know, if you couple that with what you were saying about forcing them to either ride a bicycle or buy a car that's going to keep them in a perpetual state of debt as another form of renter, then it takes us right back into this, you know, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy.
Yeah, there are all kinds of synergies here. And with regard to real estate, and this is, I'm sure you're more in your department than mine, but I've noted that, or I think that part of what's driving that is zoning. You no longer have, like, I'll contrast what you talked about a moment ago with my area, where there aren't, I live in a county that has no zoning, if you can imagine that.
Yeah, it's like Houston.
So the result of that is that you'll have a single family home, a sizable single family home on, 5, 10, 15 acres. And then adjacent to it, you might have a single wide, you know, on a half acre. And in between of that, you might have 1,000 square foot little, you know, little starter house like you were talking about. So there are lots of choices for different price points, and there's an incentive to meet that need. And it works when you take away the zoning. Now, you know, what the zoning has done in the scenario that you described is to render one size fits all. And of course, one size doesn't fit all, it fits some. And it forces those who can't afford that $500,000, 2,500 square foot McMansion back into the apartment in the city.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's I would assume that the housing costs in your area are relatively low.
Well, they were until the world went crazy 2 years ago. Prices around here have skyrocketed as people have come here from, I'm assuming, Northern Virginia and other places where sickness, psychosis is more extreme. Property values around here have increased, I'd say, on average by 45 to 50%, if not more. And you may have some insight on this. I've been trying to understand it. I get, people having them, you know, say you live in Northern Virginia where rents are high and real estate costs are high, and you cash out your house there and you've got $500,000 and you come to an area like this where $500,000 buys you the equivalent of what $2 million would buy you in Northern Virginia, let's say,
right,
in terms of house and land. But somebody's got to be buying those houses up in Northern Virginia. Who's doing that? Who's buying the houses and who's buying the condos in New York? Everybody seems to be fleeing those areas. So my understanding is that the real estate market is hot everywhere, not just in rural areas. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. And for most areas, that's absolutely correct in urban areas. And I think it's people that, when you, I hate to use the word money printing, because on my channel, you know, we go into the economic details that show that, you know, just increasing the Fed's balance sheet isn't necessarily money printing.
Right.
But if you look at a chart of the deposits, the checking deposits, so the dollars in the American checking deposit household in aggregate total, going into 2020 is right around $1.2 trillion. So the the aggregate total of American households had $1.2 million in their checking accounts. Today, that's over $3.7
trillion. Wow.
So when you're increasing the amount of dollars in the real economy chasing goods and services, it's going to be like all boats in the harbor rise with the tide.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's going to be money they're pouring into it. And then a lot of people are not selling. And then a lot of these properties are being purchased by private equity funds, you know, because what's happening is the Fed keeps interest rates low for so long that it pushes large pools of money, including the retail investor, out the risk curve. So they've got to take more and more and more risk. And a lot of these large pools of money, and they've been doing it since 2012, really, are looking at rental properties as a way to increase their yields. So you've got larger and larger and larger percentage of the housing stock owned by these private equity funds that are not going to sell. So the turnover for properties is a lot less. And then you have people that are in these homes that don't want to sell, or a lot fewer people that want to sell than normal. So the supply side has really dropped dramatically. So that's what you're seeing, in addition to there being trillions of more dollars on the balance sheet of the average American household in aggregate total.
That's really interesting. So the way that I interpret that is that probably another bubble is forming in the market.
Oh yeah. If you look at housing prices adjusted for inflation going back to 1900, and this is a chart I use on my videos all the time, you'll see that at the end of the 1990s, we pretty much were flat going back to the year 1900. So the 100 years, housing prices really didn't go up. They just kind of went up with the rate of inflation. Then which makes sense, because inflation is tied to wages or vice versa. So then what happens in early 2000s is it just goes completely parabolic to 2006 and then comes down till we get to a bottom point in 2012. Where did it bottom? It bottomed pretty much on its historic trend line going all the way back to 1900, which again makes sense because of the price to income ratio. So then where are we today would be the next question. We're far higher adjusted for inflation than we were in 2006.
Yeah.
So if you're going to argue that we were in a housing bubble in 2006, it's pretty much impossible to argue that we are not in a housing bubble in 2022.
Yeah. And I assume at some point people who have bought into this thing may not be able to continue making their payments, and then the whole thing comes crashing down.
Well, it depends. I mean, it can. So there's where it gets difficult, because it has to come back down to its historic trend line. But does it come back down in nominal prices or real prices? Because you see, nominal prices can continue to go up at, let's say, 5% per year. But if the CPI, or the real rate of inflation, is at 10% per year, you're still losing 5% per year purchasing power. So gradually going back down to that historic trend when you adjust for inflation. So it all depends on how much, quote unquote, money the government's going to print. If they continue to deficit spend like they did in 2020 and in 2021, if we get UBI, as an example, if we continue to get PPP loan, child tax credit, you name it, let's not forget that the government said that most people didn't have to pay their mortgage or didn't have to pay rent. If you continue to get these types of programs, I mean, the sky's the limit. The nominal prices can continue to go up, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're increasing your purchasing power.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. That's kind of it's a dynamic that you've got to have a deleveraging, to your point. It's just, is that going to be a deflationary deleveraging, or is that going to be an inflationary deleveraging? And, Only time will tell, but the whole economy is becoming far more precarious because the economy is becoming more and more dependent on those assets, such as real estate and the stock market, always going up.
Yeah, it seems as a common thread here. Housing, cars, everything is becoming increasingly unaffordable for average people.
Mm.
So again, they're we're returning back to this concept of being enserfed and chained to serial debt, to rental payments rather than ownership. And ownership, of course, is the fulcrum of capitalism. If you don't own things, you don't have a capitalist society anymore.
Yeah, that's a great point. So let's go back to some of your suggestions for cars that people can look into if they want to pay cash. If you just got, and let's start maybe at a $5,000 price point, maybe let's see, $5,000, let's do maybe a $10,000 and a $20,000. If you've got cash to pay for a car, if you're like, I like what Eric is saying, I want as much freedom as possible, so I just want to own a car outright in cash, what types of cars should they be looking at those three price points?
Well, I think the best car in general terms is an unpopular car. That does not mean it's a bad car. It just means that it's not desirable. And if it's not desirable, it's not going to command premium prices in the market. Tom and I were talking about this.
I know where you're going. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, a minivan, you know, people laugh. Yeah. But, another guy that you'll be familiar with, a lot of people who, I think it's Bill Sardi. I think I had this conversation with Bill Sardi about minivans. He's a minivan guy. You know who Bill Sardi is, right?
No.
Okay, well, he's often on Lou Rockwell. He's another commentator out there.
Okay.
His focus is more on medicine and health issues. But at any rate, he talks about the minivan, and I talk about the minivan. It's about the least desirable type of vehicle that there is, unless you have to have one. You know, why do people buy minivans? They buy them because they've got kids, and they need to haul their kids around. Their kids are going to spill junk. They're going to kick the seats. They're going to get mud on the carpets. You know, after 3 or 4 years, the minivan is going to be trashed. It's inevitable, right? So, you know, then you got this used minivan that has got juice stains all over the place and it's got tears in the seats, but it's solid. You know, mechanically, yeah, it's a really solid vehicle. Most minivans are based on very reliable passenger cars. For example, the Toyota Sienna, well, up until this year, it's a hybrid now, but that's a whole other thing. Historically, that has shared guts with the Toyota Camry, including the same 3.5 V6 that's optional in the Camry, which is a brilliant engine. And the Camry is about as reliable as a farmer's anvil. They just don't break. You can put 250,000 miles on those things. The same thing with the Honda Odyssey. That's another excellent van that's very closely related to the Honda Accord. People who know the Accord will know that that's just a really good, reliable vehicle. So minivans are a great choice.
They're so also- you could get an old minivan for like $5,000?
Absolutely.
Wow. Like what year?
Well, just, it depends on, you know, it depends on miles and it depends on options. You know, you just have to.
Do you think you could get like a 10 year old one or something?
8 to 10 years old, you know, depending on the mileage. You might have to pay a little bit more, but it's worth every penny. And not just because they're good vehicles, they're actually practical. You know, they're almost as practical as a truck. You take the seats out of those things. I've hauled motorcycles in minivans. You can haul 2x4s, you can haul pallets of cement and bricks in those things. Most of them will tow 3,500 pounds. So they're quite serviceable vehicles. You can park it anywhere. Nobody's going to bother a minivan.
Yeah. Did they make any that are 4x4?
All-wheel drive. Yeah. Toyota offered all-wheel drive in the Sienna. And who else offers the all-wheel drive minivan?
Because you know where I'm
all-wheel drive with the Pacifica and the Voyager vans.
You know where I'm going with this, Eric, is I see more of these Sprinter vans, and sure. I don't know if you see this in your area. Yes. I mean, as maybe 5 years ago, or even 3 years ago, I would never see one of these like decked out Sprinter van, like these bug out Sprinter vans. Now I see 10 of them a day. I just go over to the Whole Foods here across the street, and there's always 3 or 4 of them in the parking lot with these massive tires and mountain bikes in the back. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though, for obvious reasons, this is becoming very, very popular in today's society, where they want to do the exact opposite of what the global elite want us to do. Right. And they want to get out and away from the insanity of the city. They want to go camping and do all these things. So they're taking these big 4x4 Sprinter vans and decking them out like a little RV that they can cook in there and everything. My question is, could you do the same type of thing with maybe one of these cheaper minivans?
Standard family type van? Sure, absolutely. You know, the Sprinter is a more expensive proposition. Of course, it's a Mercedes to begin with. So, you know, you're going to pay more for that just by dint of the three-pointed star. And it's available with a diesel engine, which is an outstanding feature to have for a variety of reasons. And it can pull more. But yeah, I mean, the standard family type minivan may not be as capable, but it's pretty close.
Really, yeah, you could set it up to where you could camp in it maybe, and you could kind of get out into the woods a little bit.
Yeah. Now people are going to laugh for a beater car. You know, when it comes back to that $5,000 price point.
Yeah.
Something you might want to look at is Walter White's car, the Pontiac Aztec or the Buick Rendezvous. Hideously ugly.
I remember those.
They're not bad vehicles. And you can probably, pick one of those up for substantially less than $5,000.
And the Aztec was kind of a crossover vehicle, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a crossover. You know, hideously ugly, but very cool. You know, they offered things like you could get a over-the-counter at the dealer tent kit that bolted to the back of the thing and turned the back of it into a tent.
Yeah.
All kinds of cool features and dirt cheap. And it has a solid GM V6 drivetrain, nothing elaborate, nothing that's failure prone. You know, if you can stand the sea of oozing injection molded plastic everywhere, and that's just an aesthetic issue, it's a good vehicle.
Well, that's a great suggestion. What about a Quigley van? And I just wrote this down. I don't know much about them, but a good buddy of mine is, this is what he does for a living. He sells cars. He's been doing it since we were in college. He owns his own lot and everything. And I know I always hear him talk about how in demand those Quigley vans are.
Okay, now this is a new one for me. I'm not familiar with the Quigley van.
Okay, so Quigley, if I understand it correctly, was a company that would take the... what was the van? Was it the O'Connell line? I'm trying to think back, like 2000, 2001, 2002, when Ford had that van, and they had the 7.3 Power Stroke engine in it.
Yeah, the O'Connell line.
Yeah, and what they would, and then the Quigley is like a company like AMG kind of that, okay, that would take this van and they'd put a four-wheel drivetrain on it.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, the E350 van is basically a truck, you know, with the van body on it.
Yes. And then so they'd put this four-wheel drive drivetrain and these big tires on it. And yeah, then kind of like that little thing in the top to put all your luggage in there, kind of like a Defender with like the ladder in the back. Yeah. And then they'd kind of like hollow it out so you could like turn it into whatever you wanted. And I think the company that did that was Quigley.
Yep. There's a number of other small vans in that category that aren't truck-based, but are nonetheless interesting to look at. Nissan makes something called the NV van, and then there's a larger version of that that's based on the Titan truck. And Ford also has a Transit and the Transit Connect vans. And you can get these in stripped down, completely Spartan, just a metal shell configuration, brand new. And then you could do whatever you want to them. You know, you can turn it into a nice RV camper, or you can turn it into a contractor truck, whatever you want, build it to suit.
Okay, great. So that gives some ideas for some cheaper price kind of bug out vehicles. I could talk about that for the next hour, but I want to step it up a little bit to the $10,000 price point. If someone's got $10,000 in cash, they're looking for a good, solid car that's going to last them and give them that personal freedom, what would you suggest?
Well, I'd either go for something, I'd go for like probably a Toyota Camry, a Toyota Avalon. If you want something that's a little bit beefier, something like a Dodge Charger, Honda Accord, a Hyundai Sonata is a good car. Any one of these mid-sized sedans that is kind of generic and nondescript, but has an established reputation for being a really good car. And after 10 years, it's going to be very affordable and will probably give you another 10 or 15 years of service without having to do more to it than, you know, basic usual maintenance, oil and filter changes.
Can you get a good solid truck at that price point that could tow maybe an RV?
Not anymore, unfortunately. What was the number that I read about this recently? The average price of used vehicles is up more than 30% in the past 12 months. Mm-hmm. And trucks are the tip of the spear. Truck prices have gone completely batty. I could turn around right now and sell my 02 Nissan that I bought used back in 08 for $7,500 for about $7,500.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember our last conversation, but I used to basically buy and collect 1990 from 95 to 2002. Ford F-250s and F-350s. Yep. It's just like a store of value. And I've still got four of them, if I'm not mistaken. I think four of them. Most of them have under 100,000 miles. Yeah. And they're all 7.3 diesels.
Oh gosh, dude, you know what those things are worth now.
Yeah, I mean, the one I have just right here at my apartment is a 2001 F-350 crew cab long bed, 7.3 diesel. It's got 70,000 miles on it. I bought that thing for $7,000 in 2017. Now, just doing the comps on eBay, I mean, you probably know better than I would, but it's probably $35,000.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? And part of the reason for that is there's nothing comparable any longer that's new.
Mm.
You can't get anything like that anymore. You know, even get a diesel, you have to go up. Well, any kind of a decent diesel, you have to go up to a 2,500.
Yeah. So before we get to the next, the final kind of price point, 20,000, that takes me back to a question I had that I forgot to ask. We were discussing how they're trying to price people out of the market to buy new cars. But what will they do with used cars? Is it just something where at a certain point, all of the cheaper used cars will be unusable anymore just because of miles? And therefore, the only thing left are these hybrid and electric drivetrains?
I think that's what they hope. But I'm optimistic about that because I'm being involved in the car business and also in the hot rod community. I know that the tenacity and inventiveness of Americans is certainly equal to that of the Cubans. And when the Cuban government essentially made it impossible for people to get new cars back in the 50s, people somehow managed to keep those cars from the 50s and older all the way to now.
Right.
And you can do that with these older vehicles that don't have all the computer controls and the electronics. If you know, if you can turn a wrench, you can keep it going. And I think that we have a huge advantage nowadays that the Cubans didn't have even as recently as 10 years ago, in that it is now possible the technology exists to manufacture parts independently. You know, if you've got the equipment to do that, you can do things that it used to be necessary to be a major manufacturer to produce parts. You don't have to have that anymore. You know, it's just like with ARs, you can make these things at home now.
Mm. Well, that's interesting idea. Yeah, I've never really looked at Cuba as an example of what we could do here with vehicles, but that's a great point. So, another just FYI on the used car market is maybe, I think at April or March or so of 2021, I bought a McLaren 570 GT.
Oh, all right. I'm official.
And this was in Miami. And I went to take it into the dealer because I was thinking about selling it and just selling it on consignment. I was going to sell it at Barrett Jackson, but that was kind of a pain in the neck. So I'm like, if I want to sell it, I'll just give it to the local dealership. So I drove it down there and I said, what would you guys price this for? He says, well, these things are just flying off the shelves. The market for this is absolutely insane. It's like the housing market. And the price they quoted me was $45,000 more than I paid.
Yeah. Not the least bit surprised by that. You probably heard people are being solicited. You know, like let's say you bring your car in, your ordinary car, your nothing special car. You bring your Corolla into the dealer to get some service done, get the tires changed. And they make you an offer on the car. They want to buy your car because they're so desperate to get decent used vehicles so that they have something to sell.
Because they have no inventory, right?
Yeah, that's
part of it. So to help us understand why they don't have any inventory, I'm assuming it has to do with the supply shortages.
Yeah.
But how is that affecting the car market?
Well, it's affecting it hugely. You know, never before has there been a circumstance where, you go to a dealership and there's literally nothing in the showroom anymore.
Yeah.
On the lot either. And the reason for that is because of this chip, meaning semiconductor chips, shortage in the supply chains. And modern cars are tremendously dependent on these semiconductors to operate their various electronic systems. You know, cars are enormously complicated pieces of equipment now. And so while they can build the physical structure, they can build the body, they can cast the engine block and the cylinder heads and all of those things, they can't get it to work without the chips. And it's not just the drivetrain. Most people aren't aware that even something as humdrum as the power windows now is computer controlled. You know, they have body control modules that send signals to a computer, and then the signal goes back to activate the motor that opens and closes the windows. So without all of these components, they can't get everything to work. You know, they're trying to sell cars now with without heated seats, even though it's got the button for the heated seats, but the heater doesn't work because they couldn't get the chip, it's really aggravating to buyers. And of course it's ruinous to these dealers because how do they stay in business if they're not selling vehicles and not making money on servicing vehicles? And so that's why they're trying by hook or by crook, any means necessary to get something on their lots. And, used cars, at least used cars are out there and they work. And so they're trying to get them as many as they can. But I think you'd be crazy to give up your car at this point.
Are the dealers that you're talking to, are they seeing any relief in the future for the supply side?
No, not yet. This problem, you'd think it would have been solved by now. And this is something that I'm not particularly knowledgeable about. I don't understand you may know about this, the way the ships that carry the containers back and forth from China to here and how they're allotted and what's involved in the logistics. Apparently they've just not been able to sort that out. So even if they have factories running and the factories are manufacturing the chips, getting the chips from China to here and getting them installed in the vehicles is something that they haven't been able to fix yet.
It's just the economic distortions created by government intervention. What everyone would tell you, Eric, is, oh, it's because of the Cerveza sickness, the government's had to lock down and blah, 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 blah. And this is the result of all of the lockdowns because of the Cerveza sickness. And it's not because of that. It's because of the government's response.
Sure.
To the Cerveza sickness. When people are trying to figure out if these supply chains are going to get fixed, they just have to ask themselves, is there going to be more or less government intervention in the future?
More. And specifically, the thing I wanted to touch on, it occurred to me as we were talking, is that if the government didn't constantly have its thumb on the scales of the market would solve this problem. You would have Latter-day Henry Fords who would be out there right now putting together basic cars that didn't need chips, that could operate perfectly well without all of these computers, and which you could sell to people for $7,000 or $8,000. It wouldn't be in a McLaren, but it would be something that would get you to work and let you earn a living. And we can't have that because the government has decreed that all cars have to have this and they have to have that and they have to meet all of these various standards. And the result of that is that they're all dependent on these supply chains and this top-down centralized system that is creakier than Frankenstein and can never operate efficiently.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense here. Okay, before I forget, let's go back to the $20,000 price point.
Well, if you got $20,000 to spend, you're in, generally speaking, pretty good stead, except, of course, in context of a lot of what's going on now with the prices of used trucks, for example. But if you have 20 grand, there are all sorts of options open to you for nice vehicles. You could get a nearly new loaded V6 powered Camry, probably about a 4-year old model, I would think, 4 or 5 year old model. And that's a great car, by the way. It's a super sleeper. People who don't know it are, I had a buddy of mine, actually, I got to talking to him about it. He's got a Trans Am like I've got, except an older, a newer one. And he's really hung up on performance. And I said, dude, why don't you check out a V6 Camry? It'll smoke your Trans Am. He's got like a, I think it's a 99 or a 2000 Trans Am. No. And I said, yeah, seriously, check it out. The V6 Camry will do 0 to 60 in about 5 seconds. And trust me, your stock 99 Trans Am is not doing it in 5 seconds.
I remember back in the day, I had a 911, not a turbo, but a 911 Carrera S. The four-wheel drive.
Yeah.
And it did 0 to 60 in 5 seconds, if I remember. Right. It was probably like a 2004 or 5, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the power and performance that is routinely available today is striking. Almost any car that you get today, like you talk about a middle-of-the-road crossover SUV type of vehicle, that's going to get to 60 in 7 or so seconds. That's pretty quick.
Yeah.
For your basic crossover family mobile.
No kidding. Okay. So for at 20 grand, what would you suggest as far as a truck to pull like an RV?
Oh boy. If $20,000 for a truck to pull an RV, depends on if you really want to pull a heavy RV, you got a problem now because, well, not necessarily. I don't know. I've got to go look and see what they're going for. Now, if I had that kind of money and I needed to pull something substantial, when you say an RV, I'm assuming something that's more
like a trailer, like a 30-foot Airstream or something.
Yeah, I'd probably want to go back to like the mid-90s and look for a CK1500 Chevy or an F-150, something like that, something like one of your trucks. You could probably pick that up without the diesel for around that if you shop carefully. Now, Chevy made a great truck back then with the 305 or the 350 V8 throttle body injection, and it was available with a 5-speed manual transmission, which would be my pick just because it's a whole lot of fun to drive. Might not be absolutely ideal for towing. You might want an automatic for that purpose. But you could probably snatch one of those up if you look carefully and act quickly.
Yeah, for sure. At 20 grand, you could get, you might be able to get a 7.3 with like 250,000 miles on it, something like that. You could definitely get a 460.
Yeah,
that's for sure. It's just 460 is not going to get more than 5 miles to the gallon. And so you might be able to get like a 2000, standard cab, an XL. Remember the XLs?
I do. Yep.
So the XL were kind of stripped down, kind of like a more industrial use.
Yep.
And I think they made the XL even, in fact, I know they did. They made the XL even in a crew cab.
Yep. And that 460, by the way, pretty simple engine. Yeah, it gets 5 or 6 miles per gallon, but you can take that thing apart and put it back together and have it be good as new for about $3,000-$4,000.
Super cheap. Yeah, that's for sure. Super, super cheap to fix those things. All right, Eric, great conversation. Man, we got to do this more often. I could talk to you for another 3 hours on cars, and we didn't even have the chance to talk about fast cars, which is
right.
This is what I really like. I got a kind of a beater car just for driving around. It's a 2014 CLS 63, but I got the S.
Awesome, great car. Yeah.
Have you driven the S?
I have.
Yeah. I think it's got an extra like 75 horsepower on it, something like that.
That's a nice ride, but I'll raise too. One. I have been considering, and this is completely lunacy, but it's the right kind of lunacy. I've been thinking about getting a Lotus Super 7. You know what they are?
A Lotus Super 7?
Yeah. A Caterham.
Oh yeah. That's where you've got, it's open air, isn't it?
Oh yeah. I mean, it is as elemental a car as you can get. It doesn't have doors. But it's the experience, and you can pretty much get a kit. You can build it yourself, or they have turnkeys depending on, you know, your level of mechanical aptitude and or determination to do it yourself. And it has pretty much the most wicked power to weight ratio of anything on four wheels. It is quicker than most sport bikes, and it has absolutely no electronic crap whatsoever.
That reminds me, that is it like the Ariel Atom?
Very similar to that. I'm going to send you the link to their site. You'll love just watching the intro demo that they have. It gives you a sense of what's in store.
Yeah. So the last question I got for you actually is, why don't you do Doug DeMiro type videos?
Probably because I'm.
I would love to see you do those. Yeah, he's one of my favorite.
Us Gen X guys, I laud you for being hip and with it, as Dr. Evil would say, with technology. I've got like this really crappy little handheld camera thing that I use when I do my walk arounds of new cars and whatever else I'm video ranting about. But, you know, it's Soviet in terms of its sophistication. And I know I should get up to date and I should get the proper equipment and do it. And, you know, one of these days I will. I just haven't checked off that box yet.
Yeah, you got to let me help you do that. I'd be happy to assist you. And it'd be so easy because I'd love to see you do like those Doug DeMiro type of car reviews, but just through the lens of, you know, free market capitalism and everything.
Yeah,
and it would be fantastic. I'd love for you to do that. So anyway, I can help out, let me know. But for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do right now, Eric, where can they go?
Oh, just it's epautos.com. Pretty easy peasy. And they can just Google my name if they want to, and that'll pull up my website and other publications that I write for as well.
Awesome. Eric, appreciate the time. I can't wait to do it again, my friend.
Ditto, man.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.